depends on whether we see his story as a narrative about inevitability and determinism, or a narrative about choice. To Antonio Cassese, writing for the Appeals Chamber's Minority, Erdemovich's story is a tale about inevitability and the very worst sort of moral luck. Erdemovich was caught up in events beyond his control, and he had no more freedom than a pawn on a chessboard. He was an ordinary man who one day simply found himself in an untenable situation. Someone was guilty of a terrible crime at Srebrenica, no question, but it was not Dražen Erdemovich, young and frightened and anxious about the fate of his wife and child. To the majority on the appeals chamber, however, Erdemovich's story is fundamentally a narrative about choice. The majority treats Erdemovich as a moral agent whose failure was consummated at Srebrenica, but begun perhaps much earlier. Erdemovich's crime, on this view, goes back some years. Erdemovich drifted from army to army, committed to nothing but unable to bring himself to resist wholly. He was complicit, little by little, in allowing Bosnia to become one of the earth's dark places. By the time he tried finally to take a stand, it was much too late. We prefer to imagine brutal wars and atrocities as events that just happen every now and then, much like tornadoes or lightning strikes. This metaphor suggests that we can't generalize from them since they are radically discontinuous with ordinary life. But wars and atrocities do not just happen. Societies and individuals slide into them little by little, one tiny decision or omission at a time. Keeping this in mind, perhaps we can make more sense of the common law rule permitting duress as a complete defense to all crimes except murder. The rule is puzzling if we think that ordinary life always remains ordinary. For if it does, why not just be consistent and allow the duress defense across the board? But if we realize that the ordinary can become the extreme in the blink of an eye, the appeals chamber's refusal to permit duress as a defense to murder seems less an anomaly than a stern warning of how easily events can slide out of control. Perhaps the rule is meant to say to us, if you find yourself having to choose between killing an innocent person and preserving your own life, you have already chosen wrong. Perhaps the rule is meant to warn us that the contours of darkness and war are often indistinct, and by the time we see that war has swallowed us whole, it's usually too late. Of course, the Srebrenica massacre could not have occurred without countless political and moral failures of the first order, made by people and institutions with far more power than Dražen Erdemovich. Recall that in 1995, unable to summon the political will to take sides in the Bosnian conflict or impose a peace, but dogged by media reports of atrocities against civilians, the United Nations Security Council came up with the idea of declaring certain areas within Bosnia UN safe areas, to which civilians could go and be protected by UN peacekeeping troops. Srebrenica was one such safe area, and in the summer of 1995, thousands of Bosnian Muslim civilians poured into Srebrenica to seek protection from the incursions of the Bosnian Serb army and paramilitaries. As the plurality opinion in the Erdemovich case dryly notes, however, the Dutch UN troops protecting the safe area of Srebrenica, the judges had enough sense of shame to keep the term in quotation marks, surrendered their weapons to the Serbs and withdrew rather than risk a fight. It was their abandoned civilian charges who were brought by the busload for Erdemovich and his fellow soldiers to slaughter. Naturally, none of the Dutch UN peacekeepers were ever brought up on criminal charges for their failure to protect the civilians they were pledged to protect, and no high-ranking UN officials were charged as accomplices in the murder of the thousands who died, and none of the Security Council powers who gave the UN leaders their marching orders will ever be called to account in a court of law. When the Hague Tribunal was established by the United Nations Security Council in 1993, it represented the first major international judicial effort to punish and deter atrocities since the Nuremberg and Tokyo tribunals nearly 50 years earlier. Its formation was linked in the minds of many of its creators with the long-term goal of creating a permanent international criminal court, one that could truly act as the conscience of humankind and ensure the end of impunity for war criminals and those committing genocide or crimes against humanity. But the tribunal was a creature of the UN bureaucracy. It was accountable to no one in particular, unrooted in any legal or political culture, and unable to connect in any meaningful way to the people whose lives it claimed to affect. Since it depended upon the military muscle and intelligence reports of its Security Council sponsors, the tribunal was, by itself, nearly toothless. It couldn't get the NATO powers to arrest any of its most wanted, but still politically useful, criminals. Despite its lack of coercive powers, the tribunal could and did lock up former private Dražen Erdemović. There had to be a sacrificial lamb. Given the failure of the international community to prevent the Srebrenica massacre and the embarrassing inability of the tribunal to get its hands on any high-ranking suspects, how could the tribunal let the very first defendant brought before it, a man who admitted killing scores of innocent people, walk free? Perhaps then, Erdemović's conviction was an act of expiation, one that allowed the majority on the appeals chamber to use law as a mechanism for bearing witness to the moral failures of our collective institutions, including the law itself. Or perhaps the ultimate message is this: law cannot fully tame war, despite the dreams of Francis Lieber and Henri Dunant, but it can still serve as a signpost pointing us toward one future rather than another, and reminding us that we always have choices to make. Chapter 12, Making War. War made the state, and the state made war. Charles Tilly. Return for a moment to the question of whether we can define war. I noted that international law does not offer a precise definition of armed conflict, and different societies have sought to delineate the boundaries of war in different ways. But causation runs in both directions. Just as different societies define war in different ways of understanding and defining war can end up shaping quite different societies. Political sociologist Charles Tilly famously argued that the history of the Western state is inextricably bound up with the history of European warfare. To oversimplify Tilly's nuanced and complex arguments, the story goes something like this. As power holders, originally bandits and local strongmen, sought to expand their power, they needed capital to pay for weapons, soldiers, and supplies. The need for capital and new recruits drove the creation of taxation systems and census mechanisms, and the need for more effective systems of taxation and recruitment necessitated better roads, better communications, and better record-keeping. This, in turn, enabled the creation of larger and more technologically sophisticated armies. The complexity and expense of maintaining more professionalized standing armies made it increasingly difficult for non-state groups to compete with states, giving centralized states a war-making advantage and enabling them to increasingly monopolize the means of large-scale violence. But the need to recruit, train, and sustain ever larger and more sophisticated armies also put pressure on these states to provide basic services, improving nutrition, education, and so on. Ultimately, we arrive at the late 20th century European welfare state, with its particular trade-offs between the state and its subjects. By now, Tilly's claim that war made the state and the state made war is so widely accepted among scholars that it has become almost a truism, at least with regard to European history. So much so that we're apt to forget that the process of war-making and state transformation remains ongoing, and isn't merely a matter for the history books. Though there is nothing deterministic or teleological about it, the cycle described by Tilly still continues. Today, as in the past, the state makes war, and the manner in which the state makes war drives further changes in the shape of the state itself and in the relationship between individuals and the state. The state makes war in several different senses. Most obviously, it is the state that wages war. The state chooses which wars to fight and how to fight them. In 2001, for instance, the United States decided to go to war in Afghanistan, first relying largely on air power in conjunction with small numbers of Army Special Forces troops and CIA paramilitary personnel, then expanding the military effort until, by 2010, the force in Afghanistan consisted of roughly 100,000 troops. Similarly, in 2003, the United States chose to invade Iraq, launching an 8-year war. By 2007, troop levels in Iraq peaked at nearly 170,000. These traditional forms of state war-making have budgetary implications and opportunity costs, and fit into Tilly's paradigm in obvious ways. But the state makes war in other senses as well. Scholars and lawyers can argue until they're blue in the face about the proper theoretical definition of war, But for all practical purposes, war is whatever powerful states say it is. From an institutional perspective, it is the state, through the apparatus of government, that decides which tasks to assign to civilian entities and which tasks to assign to the military. And from a legal perspective, it is the state that defines what will be considered a war and what will not. The United States' initial response to 9/11 is a case in point. The attacks might have been defined as egregious acts of criminality, mass murders or massive crimes against humanity, for instance. The United States instead chose to define the 9/11 attacks and the U.S. response as an armed conflict, with consequences more far-reaching than almost anyone could then have imagined. In the days and weeks immediately after September 11, 2001, the 9/11 terrorist attacks became, for many, the legal equivalent of a Rorschach test. While most commentators insisted that there was a manifestly correct and a manifestly incorrect way to understand which legal framework should be applied to the attacks, there was little agreement on just what that legal framework should be. Depending on the observer, the 9/11 attacks were variously construed as criminal acts, acts of war, or something in between. In liberal and libertarian-leaning circles, for instance, many scholars took the view that since the 9/11 attacks were carried out by non-state actors, using nothing that resembled traditional weapons, they were best understood as criminal acts. Though they were crimes of a frightening magnitude and complexity, the attacks were considered by such scholars to be appropriately addressed through an ordinary law enforcement paradigm. Such commentators roundly dismissed the notion that the attacks could trigger a war between the United States and Al-Qaeda. As Antonio Cassese, the first president of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, wrote in 2001, "It is obvious that in this case, war is a misnomer. War is an armed conflict between two or more states." James Cole, a prominent government and private attorney who was later appointed Deputy Attorney General by President Obama, similarly insisted in a 2002 article that, "For all the rhetoric about war, the September 11th attacks were criminal acts of terrorism against a civilian population, much like the terrorist acts of Timothy McVeigh." "September 11th was a devastating crime," Cole continued, "but one for which ordinary criminal law offered the most appropriate framework." Amnesty International took the same view. But others insisted with equal certainty on the correctness of the opposite proposition. Insofar as the 9/11 attacks stemmed from overseas and caused death and destruction on a scale more commonly associated with armed conflict than with crime, they should be conceptualized as acts of war, triggering the law of armed conflict. On the evening of September 11th, with smoke still swirling above the ruins of the World Trade Center and estimates of the dead ranging as high as 10,000, President Bush promised that America would win the war against terrorism. 2 days later, he told reporters that on 9/11, an act of war was declared on the United States of America. Although his phrasing was murky, his meaning was not. "The war on terrorism," said Bush, "would be the first war of the 21st century." Bush administration lawyers elaborated on the president's words. As Justice Department lawyers John Yoo and James C. Ho put it, "The attacks were coordinated from abroad by a foreign entity with the primary aim of inflicting massive civilian casualties and loss. The head of Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, declared war on the United States as early as 1996. Finally, the scope and the intensity of the destruction is one that in the past could only have been carried out by a nation state and should qualify the attacks as an act of war." Although the Obama administration has moved away from the global war on terror language favored by the Bush administration, its legal analysis has been strikingly similar. As former White House counterterrorism advisor John Brennan, now the CIA director, put it a few years ago, "We are at war with Al-Qaeda. In an indisputable act of aggression, Al-Qaeda attacked our nation and killed nearly 3,000 innocent people." President Obama has repeated the same sentiment on numerous occasions, leaving little room for doubt. "Under domestic law and international law, the United States is at war with Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and their associated forces." Duck rabbits. So who was right? Were the 9/11 attacks crime or war or something in between? Isolated attacks triggering a temporary U.S. right to use force in self-defense, but not a full-fledged armed conflict? Despite the vociferousness with which they were defended, none of the positions outlined above can be said to be clearly right or clearly wrong from a legal perspective. To a significant extent, the legal status of 9/11 is effectively indeterminate. If we think of law as being game-like, you could say that these positions posed entirely novel questions that the rules of the game simply didn't address. Until about 40 years ago, tennis rackets were made of wood and generally all strung the same way. When a professional tennis player in the mid-1970s began to play with double-stringed rackets, some players gained an immediate advantage, one that many critics viewed as unfair. But the rules of tennis didn't specify whether any particular racket stringing techniques were prohibited. Only in 1978 did the International Tennis Federation clarify the rules. Since then, new racket technologies have raised similar issues. Wooden rackets were replaced by steel, then aluminum, then graphite and composites containing titanium and tungsten. Each new racket was lighter and stronger, permitting more powerful strokes with less effort. And each new technological leap raised similar questions. When is a tennis racket no longer a tennis racket? At what point does a new technology change things so fundamentally that the players aren't even playing tennis anymore, but a new game that will require new rules? In the real world of law and war, new actors and new technologies present similar challenges. Sometimes the rules just don't offer a right and wrong answer. Or take a different metaphor. At the end of Georgetown Law's 2015 spring semester, a student in my Law and War seminar knocked on my office door. "Hey, Professor Brooks," he said cheerfully, reaching into his backpack. "We got a present for you." Grinning, he pulled out a six-pack of beer. "Beer?" I said. "Was there something about my teaching style that made you think I need to drink more beer?" "No, no," he said. "You have to look more closely at this." He held it out to me and I started to laugh. "You found duck rabbit beer! I can't believe it!" The six-pack was emblazoned with an image of Ludwig Wittgenstein's famous duck rabbit, which could equally be viewed as a representation of a rabbit or a representation of a duck. Over the course of the semester, my students became convinced that I was obsessed with the duck rabbit, which Wittgenstein used to illustrate his theory of language games. The duck rabbit, I informed anyone who would listen, offered a full explanation of legal indeterminacy in applying the law of armed conflict to modern realities. No, really. Stay with me here. To Wittgenstein, it was erroneous to imagine that words were straightforward representations of some fixed external reality. Rather, he insisted, language itself is inseparable from context. The speaking of language is part of an activity or a form of life. He noted, "The picture of the duck rabbit might have been shown me, and I never have seen anything but a rabbit in it. But imagine now I see two pictures, with the duck rabbit surrounded by rabbits in one, by ducks in the other." When the duck rabbit is surrounded by images that are unambiguously rabbits, engaged in typically rabbit-like activities, one would never think to see the duck rabbit as anything but a quickly sketched rabbit. But when the duck rabbit is surrounded by images that are unambiguously of ducks, engaged in duck-like activities, one would be equally unlikely to see the duck rabbit as anything other than a duck. I do not notice that the original duck rabbit image is the same in each of these two pictures, wrote Wittgenstein. Does it follow from this that I see something different in the two cases? Like Wittgenstein's duck rabbit, the 9/11 attacks can be viewed as crime, as war, or as isolated armed attack. And just as the duck rabbit may strike the viewer differently when surrounded by a backdrop of rabbits versus a backdrop of ducks, a great deal depends on whether one views 9/11 against a backdrop of crimes or a backdrop of military attacks. Considered alongside the Oklahoma City bombing, the murderous activities of Mexican drug cartels, or the Rwandan genocide, the 9/11 attacks look like crimes. Crimes on a massive scale. Even crimes against humanity, but crimes all the same. Considered alongside the 1976 hijacking of an Air France jet or the 1998 bombings of U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania, the 9/11 attacks might look like isolated violent incidents that could nonetheless trigger a temporary right to respond with armed force in self-defense. Considered alongside the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, the 1998 embassy bombings, and the 2000 attack on the USS Cole, The 9/11 attacks look like another stage in an ongoing armed conflict. Ultimately, as with Wittgenstein's Duck Rabbit, it would be quite mistaken to insist that one description of the attacks is somehow ontologically truer than any other, and equally mistaken to insist that there is a right and wrong legal paradigm through which to make sense of the 9/11 attacks. To say that there is neither a right nor wrong legal framework is not the same as saying that one might as well pick one as another, for the choice of legal frameworks is far from inconsequential. Indeed, if it comes to that, the choice of duck versus rabbit is also far from inconsequential if one is a hunter, or, for that matter, if one is a rabbit or a duck. If it's duck hunting season but not rabbit hunting season, ducks are fair game but rabbits are immune from violence. If it's rabbit hunting season but not duck hunting season, the opposite is true. The lawfulness of the hunter's shot depends on whether we view the duck rabbit as duck or as rabbit. For the duck rabbit, survival itself is at stake. So it is with the post-9/11 choice of legal frameworks. If the 9/11 attacks were a crime, they'd trigger law enforcement rules that place substantial constraints on the state's ability to monitor, search, detain, and use lethal force against individuals. If the 9/11 attacks were part of an armed conflict or initiated an armed conflict, they trigger the law of war, which places far fewer constraints on the state's use of coercion and lethal force. Ontologically, there may be no right answer, but power has a way of reshaping reality. In the world we inhabit, the United States is the only superpower still standing. And though its relative global power may be in decline, it still has an outsized ability to impose its vision of the facts and the law on the rest of the world. What is more, when a state makes war in this manner, redefining what counts as war, the shape of the state itself may begin to change along with relationships between individuals and the state. Trust me, this makes even more sense once you've enjoyed a few bottles of Duck Rabbit beer. Chapter 13. Making the State. The state makes war, and war, plus a good dollop of Western imperialism, made the modern state. Today, the state continues to make war, both in the traditional sense and by moving a range of new and non-traditional activities, from counterterrorism to cyber operations, into the legal and policy box labeled war. This, too, is eroding the customary boundaries between the world of war and the world of peace. New kinds of war and state war making are, in turn, remaking, and in some ways unmaking, the state itself, and are also transforming the international order and relationships between individuals and states. To trace these changes, it's worth thinking briefly about where states come from and what they do. And just as we sometimes end up trying to make sense of war by emphasizing those things that are not war, chess, rugby, homicide, riots, economic competition, trade sanctions, perhaps the best way to understand states is to start by thinking about what we call failed states. In the years since the end of the Cold War, the international community and the community of international lawyers has become increasingly preoccupied with failed states. Successful states control defined territories and populations, conduct diplomatic relations with other states, monopolize legitimate violence within their territories, and succeed in providing adequate social goods to their populations. Failed states, their dark mirror image, lose control over the means of violence and cannot create peace or stability for their populations or control their territories. Recent examples of failed states are familiar to us all, from the total collapse of state institutions in Somalia and the disintegration of the former Yugoslavia, to the varied crises in Syria, Iraq, Libya, Afghanistan, Sudan, Rwanda, Haiti, Congo, and Sierra Leone. One notch up the food chain from failed states are the numerous weak or failing states, which together constitute much of sub-Saharan Africa. Consider Côte d'Ivoire, Zimbabwe, Mali, Burundi, Mozambique, Liberia, and Angola, to name but a few of the most notorious. Significant chunks of Central Asia and parts of Latin America and South Asia. Failed states make it even harder to keep war in a box. They can become breeding grounds for extremism and insurgencies, or staging points for organized terrorist groups. Failed states cannot enter into or abide by treaties. They cannot participate in the increasingly dense network of international trade or environmental human rights agreements and institutions. They cannot enforce contracts between their citizens and foreigners or protect settled property interests. Even weak states pose this problem. How do we determine whether Pakistan has consented to U.S. drone strikes, for instance, when the locus of legitimate government authority within Pakistan is itself contested? So far, the international community has not proven particularly adept either at staving off state failure or at reconstituting failed states. From Bosnia and Sierra Leone to Afghanistan and Iraq, where the collapse of government institutions was, of course, externally induced, efforts to turn failed states back into successful states have produced tenuous stability at best. There are many reasons for this. Most are complex, but for now, focus on one. The international community is itself a fiction, at least insofar as the term implies a cohesive community of states with the capacity to act in a reliably coordinated and effective fashion. The international community is a hodgepodge of actors and institutions with divergent interests, natures, and capacities. There are states, to begin with. Some of these are powerful, the United States, China, Russia, Germany, the United Kingdom. And some are weak, Ukraine, Afghanistan, Georgia, Bosnia. Some are relatively outward-looking, Canada, while others are relatively inward-looking, China, and many are in between. States differ in territory, population, ideology, culture, and wealth, though as a matter of international law, they are united by the shared myth of sovereign equality. And states are far from the only actors on the world stage. Their influence is simultaneously challenged and extended by an ever-widening range of non-state actors. Some of these are more or less benevolent, Save the Children, Human Rights Watch, while others are fundamentally disruptive, the self-styled Islamic State, Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, the Lord's Resistance Army. Of these, some are extraordinarily rich and powerful. The Islamic State, for instance, has an estimated $500 billion kitty. Others operate on a shoestring. Still other non-state entities are more ambivalent in nature. Consider for-profit corporate entities, for instance, which may be exceptionally powerful. Walmart's and ExxonMobil's annual revenues exceed those of all but the world's richest states. And these are only some of the publicly declared world actors. Illicit regional and global networks, such as drug cartels, weapons smugglers, and human traffickers, also abound. What's more, many of these non-state actors, whether licit or illicit, also have complex and sometimes hidden links to states. Little wonder, then, that the international community struggles to respond effectively to the challenges posed by failed states. From the perspective of an alien observer from another planet, the international community of the planet Earth would surely appear like a failed state writ large. It has proven consistently unable to control the violence of powerful actors, whether states or non-state entities such as terrorist organizations, control environmental catastrophes such as climate change, remedy astronomically large economic inequities between individuals and societies, constrain the devastating scramble to exploit the Earth's dwindling natural resources, or address crises such as global epidemics. Just as Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq are fractured into numerous competing ethnic and religious groups dominated by warlords and other regional power brokers, the international order still better resembles a Hobbesian struggle for survival than a coherent system of governance. If there is some sense in which all the world's people constitute a society, and why not insist on that in this era of globalization and human rights, it is hard not to conclude that the international community is simply a failed state on a global scale. But that's silly. The obvious rejoinder to this claim is that it makes no sense at all to think of the international order as a failed state, since the international order has never been, and has never truly sought to be, a successful state. If we see chaos, poverty, disease, environmental depredation, and enormous unchecked violence around the globe today, this can be attributed to many causes, from original sin to collective action problems, take your pick. But it can hardly be attributed to some sort of state failure, to the collapse of once functioning global governance institutions, since such institutions never existed. By definition, the international order cannot be considered a failed state on a global scale, because there never existed a global state that could fall apart. But is it so silly to analogize the international order to a failed state? True, there never was a global state that existed, so it seems odd to speak of the international community as a failed state. But much the same could be said of many failed states on the national level. That is, most so-called failed states were never really states in the first place, at least not in anything more than a strictly technical sense. Afghanistan was never a fully functioning modern state. Neither was Congo, or Sierra Leone, or Syria, or Iraq, or Somalia, or most of the dozens of states that have been characterized in the past decades as failed or failing. With their boundaries often drawn by colonial and imperial powers, these faux states made for tidy maps and had seats at the United Nations and an international juridical personality. But they rarely possessed the attributes of robust states in other than a purely formal legal sense. From their inception, such states rarely exercised anything approaching a monopoly on violence within their territories. To a significant extent, their borders were unmanageably porous, and the reach of government authority either barely extended beyond their capital cities and a handful of other urban centers, or extended only in predatory form. Whether through incapacity, lack of resources, massive corruption, repression, or all four, most provided basic services only sporadically and poorly, and left their populations to fend more or less for themselves. At best, these states were, for a time, fragile facsimiles of the nation-states that appeared to thrive in Western Europe and parts of the Americas. During the Cold War, they were propped up by the competing superpowers. With the end of the Cold War, many were revealed as the faux states they had been all along. If the descent into failed state status requires some prior period as a functioning state, places such as Syria, Sierra Leone, and Afghanistan can hardly be considered failed states. They never really were states to begin with. Born in blood. We can go further. Maybe the apparent permanence and ubiquity of the nation-state is just a mirage. We take it for granted that states are, and ought to be, and must be, the building blocks of world order, viewed historically, the nation-state is a transient and contingent form of social organization. In fact, the history of the modern state is short and not particularly happy. Since prehistory, groups of human beings have found a very wide range of ways to organize themselves into societies. The world has seen tribes, sects, feudal kingdoms, city-states, and religious empires, among other modes of social organization. The idea of the territorial nation-state as the locus of authority within a system of formally equivalent similar states is of quite recent vintage. It was not until 1648, when the Peace of Westphalia ended the 30 Years' War, that the modern international system of sovereign states began to develop. Even after this symbolic starting point, it took centuries of conquest and many more wars before anything truly resembling today's state system took shape. In Europe, state consolidation was rarely peaceful. Consider the three wars of the German unification, or the bloody excesses of the Italian unification. It was the carnage of the Battle of Solferino that inspired Henri Dunant to form the International Committee of the Red Cross, and led indirectly to the emergence of the modern law of armed conflict. Or think of France, during the Reign of Terror that followed the French Revolution. France's revolutionary government publicly beheaded an estimated 30 to 40,000 people, all in the name of liberté, égalité, and fraternité. In the early 1790s, at least 150,000 other unfortunate French citoyens were shot, burned to death, hacked to pieces, or deliberately drowned in France's Vendée region. "I crushed the children under the feet of the horses," French General François-Joseph Westermann is said to have written after one particularly brutal campaign. "I massacred the women who, at least for these, will not give birth to any more brigands. I have exterminated all. The roads are sown with corpses." National identity for the peoples of Europe didn't come about naturally. It had to be created in a process that only accelerated in the 19th century. Monuments were built and national anthems composed. regional dialects and various particularisms stamped out by central authorities, often ruthlessly. In the brutality of its state-building efforts, the so-called Islamic State is less historically atypical than we might prefer to imagine. One can see the ferocious militarism that has characterized Europe until the post-World War II period as a direct result of state expansion and nationalism. Or alternately, in line with Charles Tilly's argument, one can see state formation and nationalism as incidental byproducts of militarism, as warlords required ever more elaborate infrastructural support to fund and sustain their armies. Either way, few scholars would dispute that the history of the state as the dominant form of social organization is a history dripping with blood. This has been as true in the rest of the world as in Europe. Although empires and kingdoms have long existed around the globe, the modern state largely spread outward from Europe through imperialism and colonial expansion. In the Americas, indigenous populations were small and lacked sophisticated military technologies, and European colonists soon killed or marginalized them. Then, drawing on their own political traditions, the colonists quickly replicated the state structures of Europe. Soon enough, the colonists insisted on independence from their parent states, and new states were born, often through violent rebellion. Meanwhile, in Africa, Asia, and South Asia, where they found indigenous populations more formidable, the European powers, often loosely represented by commercial enterprises acting under state charters, such as the British East India Company, first established nominally independent puppet states, which they often molded out of far more varied local forms of social organization, such as tribe and city. Quickly enough, however, most abandoned the charade of local rule in favor of straightforward colonial regimes. Ultimately, Africa's and Asia's most portable natural resources were depleted, and two world wars made maintaining colonies an expensive luxury. At the same time, and not coincidentally, emerging global norms of self-determination, non-discrimination, and human rights made colonial regimes more difficult to justify. As indigenous elites began to demand independence, often through violence, still more states were formed. Their governance structures generally mirrored the internal governance structures bequeathed them by Europe's colonial powers, and their borders notoriously reflected happenstance and inter-European conflicts and compromises, rather than any pre-colonial political or social units. The state as failure. The state as we know it today is thus of recent origin, and there is little that is natural or inevitable about this system. States are the product of both a unique history and of multiple conscious human choices, and there is no reason to view the state as a particularly successful or benign mode of social organization. Even in Europe, the birthplace of the modern state, the history of the state has been a history of repression and war. As states expanded, they consumed or trampled on other, weaker social systems. As they vied for dominance, they sent millions to be slaughtered on battlefield after battlefield, and as they sought to create unified national cultures, they frequently cannibalized their own citizens, a process that reached its terrible apotheosis in the Nazi state's genocidal policies. This is a story familiar to international lawyers, and a happy ending is usually proffered. The United Nations Charter and the emergence of human rights law. But these new norms and institutions have hardly ended state predation. Even in Europe, ethnic cleansing in the former Yugoslavia is only the most recent chapter in that story. The best that can be said of the state in Europe and the Americas may be that it proved a form of social organization well suited to the era of industrialization, and that its excesses have to some extent been tamed by the UN charter system on the outside and by relatively robust internal checks and balances on the inside. Outside of Europe, the state has hardly been kinder or gentler, and it has certainly been less successful as state success is traditionally evaluated. In most places, much of Africa, much of Central and South Asia, parts of the Americas, the state was never more than a semi-fictional overlay of institutions that masked more protean forms of social organization, such as tribal systems or patronage networks. When the Cold War ended, some of these states simply reverted, more or less messily and painfully and visibly, into whatever it was that they had always been. In other societies, new and often even more lethal modes of social organization emerged. In Afghanistan, for instance, The secular, Russian-influenced state that had displaced the traditional tribal system was itself displaced, first by violent and corrupt warlords and then by the Taliban, which forced its extremist version of Islam and Sharia law onto all populations under its control. In parts of Africa, tribal networks weakened by foreign rule and urbanization were superseded, after decolonization, by brutal and anarchic rebel groups intent only on seizing resources, regardless of the mayhem left in their wake. To a significant extent, the state in the developing world has offered its citizens all the violence that accompanied European state formation, and few of the corresponding benefits. Weak, failing, and failed states are not the exception in many parts of the world. They are the norm, and have been since their inception. Despite the many weak and failing states and the increasing number of non-state entities that compete with them, the modern international order still relies on the fiction of sovereignty. States make international law, and they create, finance, and staff the international organizations designed to enforce international law, from the United Nations itself to the International Criminal Court. Without states, without their votes at the UN, their militaries, their treasuries, and their bureaucracies, however weak and dysfunctional, the world currently has no mechanism for solving global problems. But from the inception of the post-World War II international system, human rights have run smack into sovereignty, a contradiction at the heart of the UN Charter itself. Principles of sovereignty tell us that if Saudi Arabia prefers to prohibit voting by women, or the Serbian government wants to slaughter its own citizens, that's sad, but it's no one else's business. Just as it's no one else's business if Afghanistan is run by corrupt warlords or the government of Thailand is ousted in a military coup. Principles of human rights tell us the opposite. People are people, whether they were born in Riyadh, Beijing, Srebrenica, or Damascus. And when a government oppresses or slaughters its own people, stopping the abuses is everyone's business. For Americans, this is a familiar concept. Our own nation is premised on the self-evident idea that there are unalienable rights that predate and trump the rights of government. Recall the Declaration of Independence. It is to secure these rights that governments are instituted, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. But whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it. Such a philosophy, which is also implicit in the concept of international human rights, has inescapable implications for sovereignty and international law. If the rights and needs of individuals trump those of the artificial constructs we call states, why should international law prohibit intervention into the affairs of sovereign states? If a state can't or won't protect the human beings who live within its borders, why should the international system protect that state? Why should those of us living in other states hesitate to intervene to help our fellow human beings if necessary? States created an international architecture built upon a joint commitment to sovereignty and human rights. But today, that very same joint commitment is also contributing to the unraveling of the state itself. Chapter 14, Unmaking Sovereignty. The United Nations charter system that arose out of the devastation of the Second World War was far from perfect, but most scholars nonetheless credit it with dramatically reducing the number of wars between states. When the Cold War ended, many believed the world was poised for an era of genuine peace. The threat of nuclear war between the Soviet Union and the United States was finally over, and the threat of proxy conflicts between puppet states aligned with one or the other superpower also appeared to be over. But even as the threat of interstate conflict receded, the post-Cold War world began to experience what looked like a resurgence of messy internal conflicts within states, exemplified by the ethnic conflicts that racked Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia in the early 1990s. During the 1994 Rwandan genocide, the international community stood by as the bodies piled up. Nearly a million people were slaughtered in a matter of a few short months. In the former Yugoslavia, the situation was not quite as shameful for the international community, which did ultimately act, with Security Council approval, to end the savage and bloody conflicts in Bosnia and Croatia. But most critics felt that the international community did too little too late. The glaring inadequacy of the international community's response to the crises in Rwanda and Bosnia led to a good deal of hand-wringing and an understandable and appropriate sense of guilt. Being bystanders to genocide, as Samantha Power put it in her powerful 2002 book, A Problem from Hell, wasn't a comfortable role. The general sense was that the international community, led by the UN Security Council, should have done more, or at least should have done something. Political leaders, the media, and advocacy groups all asked, can it possibly be the case that it's acceptable, legally or morally, for the world to stand by idly while mass atrocities are committed? In particular, can the rest of us stand by when mass atrocities are committed against a population by its own government, or when a government seems unwilling or unable to protect its people from those who prey upon them? You will tell the world. Over the years, I've seen enough misery for these to feel like urgent moral questions rather than academic or legal questions. When I read about the Lord's Resistance Army today, I still feel the same sick sense of helplessness I felt during that first trip to northern Uganda in 1997. I remember the silent woman holding up her dying baby, and the little boy, another escaped LRA victim, clad in a ragged sweatshirt declaring, "I'm a Toys R Us kid." The Toys R Us logo had mostly worn away. From a distance, his shirt just seemed to offer a silent reproach. "I'm a kid." I remember a meeting with several dozen parents of schoolgirls abducted by LRA rebels in Uganda's Lira district. My Human Rights Watch colleague, Yodan Thondon, and I were apparently the first Americans to have shown any interest in their plight. And the parents, who had formed a group dedicated to lobbying the Ugandan government to rescue their girls, greeted us with such hope and gratitude that I felt instantly shamed. The group's spokesman was a man named Ben, whose adolescent daughter was still in captivity. One of his arms hung uselessly at his side, withered and immobile. "From the rebels," a woman whispered in explanation. Ben greeted us with quiet formality. "Welcome. Welcome." He cleared his throat and spoke slowly. "We have suffered greatly, but now you are here." A murmur of soft-approval from the crowd. "Yes, you are here. We thank you. We thank you greatly, for we know you will return to America and you will tell the world about our war here in northern Uganda. You will tell your president, Bill Clinton. Yes, you will tell him about how we suffer so much from the rebels here in northern Uganda, about how the rebels burn our homes and beat us and kill us and take our children away from us and do so many, many very bad things to them." More murmurs. "And your president, Bill Clinton, when he learns this from you, when he learns of all these very bad things these rebels are doing here, then we know he will send help to us here in northern Uganda. Yes, you will go back to America and you will tell him all these things. You will carry this message to him. And your president will help us bring our children home." Quiet applause. Later that night, I sat with Sister Rachele Fisera, an Italian nun who taught at the girls' boarding school from which the LRA had abducted so many girls, and listened to her story. It went something like this. On the night of October 9th, 1996, Sister Rachele was fast asleep when she heard the screaming. As a teacher at a Catholic girls' boarding school in the Ugandan town of Aboke, she had eaten with her girls, presided over their evening study period, and seen them safely off to bed. Now, hearing screams, she jumped up and ran to open her door. But the door had been blocked from the outside, and it took Sister Rachele and several other nuns more than an hour to escape. When they made it out, they raced to the dormitories where some hysterical younger girls told them that the LRA rebels had come and taken away scores of girls in a mass abduction. The girls who remained were the fortunate ones. They had hidden in cupboards and under beds, avoiding the rebels' notice. Sister Rachele's fellow nuns proposed radioing the nearest Ugandan army post to ask for instructions, but Sister Rachele would hear none of this. The army, she feared, probably rightly given its record, would either do nothing, or worse, would send out a unit that would end up killing the hostages alongside the rebels. "I will go get our girls myself," she told her incredulous colleagues. And she did. Along with John, the school handyman, she set out into the bush. The trail wasn't hard to follow. Like modern-day Hansels and Gretels, the girls had left a trail of discarded items, scraps of paper, candy wrappers, the contents of their pockets. She and John tramped through the bush, and finally, around dawn, they caught up with the rebel party. Sister Rachele walked right up to the rebel commander, a young man in his 20s, and demanded that he release her girls immediately. The commander was used to terrified, cringing villagers. Sister Rachele was a tiny, bird-like little woman in her 50s with thick glasses and hair pulled severely back, and she seemed completely unafraid. Who was this nun? Flummoxed, he said, "Sister, I cannot let these girls go. I must bring these girls back with me." But Sister Rachele wouldn't take no for an answer. Ignoring the dozens of armed rebels, she told the commander he should be ashamed of himself. A big, strong man kidnapping young girls who only wanted to go to school and get an education so they could make their country better. The rebel commander could have killed her, but instead he proposed a compromise. "Sister, I will pick the prettiest, strongest girls and take them with me. You may take the others back." Sister Rachele refused the deal, insisting that she had to bring all the girls back with her. By now, the commander was growing irritated. "Sister, you can take back with you 100 girls, but I will take the others with me. If you do not want to leave with 100 girls, I will kill you and take them all with me." It wasn't much of a choice. The commander walked through the terrified ranks of schoolgirls, picking those he wanted to take back with him and pulling them aside. Then, shrugging magnanimously, he pointed at the 100 girls he had rejected. "Sister, you go now, and take these girls back to their school." When Sister Rachele told me about her trek into the bush to retrieve her kidnapped charges, she was animated, reenacting the scene with Italian flair. But when she started to describe the moment she began to lead the 100 freed girls away from the rebels, something in her voice shifted. She still gesticulated dramatically, but all the energy was gone. "Ah, so I kissed each of my girls who were going with the rebels, and they were crying." Her voice cracked. "The commander was saying, 'Sister, you must leave us now.' And my girls, they were saying, 'Sister, don't leave me. Sister, what about my asthma? Sister, please stay with us. I am frightened. Sister, my father will not survive this. Sister, please, please take me with you.'" By the end of her story, Sister Rachele was sobbing. She looked up at me. "I dream each night of those girls, their voices begging me not to leave them. But I left them. I do not see how God can ever forgive me for this." I'm not religious. I'm the child and grandchild and great-grandchild of atheists. My ancestors turned their backs on Catholicism, Judaism, and Protestantism. If they had been Hindus or Muslims, I'm sure they would have managed to reject those faiths too. So I was probably the worst person in the world to comfort a weeping nun. I patted her shoulder awkwardly. "Sister," I said, "God knows no one could have done more than you did." A few days after that, I visited St. Mary's Hospital in Gulu, Uganda, where I met a doctor named Matthew Lukwena. Matthew Lukwena spent virtually all his professional life at St. Mary's Hospital. He grew up poor in the neighboring district of Kitgum, went to school and studied hard. Against all the odds, he made it to medical school at Makerere University in Kampala. Then he returned to Gulu, a few miles from his boyhood home. In 1989, when LRA rebels tried to kidnap some nuns from the hospital, Matthew insisted they take him away instead. They did. They walked him through the bush for days, but eventually, inexplicably, they let him go. Most people with his credentials and skills would have abandoned Gulu after that, but Matthew stayed on. He struggled to provide medical care to a population suffering from both poverty and war, and he turned St. Mary's Hospital into a safe haven for the night commuters, rural villagers who left their homes each evening to spend the night in the relative safety of Gulu, where LRA raids were less frequent. Each night, thousands of people would trudge quietly into the walled courtyard at St. Mary's, hauling sleeping mats and food. Each night, Matthew would make the rounds of the courtyard, offering water and basic medical care. As he walked through the camp of the night commuters, people would reach out their arms to touch him, as if his mere presence could keep them safe. When I visited St. Mary's in 1997, Matthew walked me around the overcrowded hospital, pointing out the patients sleeping on the floor and in the hallways, the nearly empty medicine stock rooms, the bodies waiting in the morgue. Finally, he offered me a chair in his bleak, cinderblock office, nothing in it but a desk and a bookshelf and a few folding chairs. He sat down, rested his elbows on his desk, and then slumped with his head in his hands. "The problem," he said tiredly, "is that we don't see an end to the problem. When you have a problem and you think it's coming to an end, then you say, let's persevere. But I really don't see how this is going to end. I foresee unlimited suffering." His eyes were wet. "I told you everyone cried. Whether you were a doctor in Gulu or U.S. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, who visited northern Uganda later that year, it seemed impossible to think about the LRA and not cry. The last 2 years have been the worst in 10 years. We cannot do anything. We cannot go outside in the community. We cannot do our work. It has to stop. It must stop." His voice trailed off. When he continued, he was almost angry. "When you are in the medical field, you are trained always to look for solutions. But I cannot see one here. There is no point to my work. I can do nothing." I listened and scribbled in my notebook, embarrassed by so much raw emotion in a stranger. It was late afternoon, and outside in the courtyard, the night commuters were lighting their cooking fires, preparing for darkness. Matthew kept talking in a low monotone. I think he had almost forgotten my presence. He did not even know how to keep his own children safe, he said. He had to shuttle them from relative to relative to protect them from rebel abduction. There was no truly safe place in northern Uganda. He wrung his hands, massaged his temples, fidgeted miserably with his pen. From time to time, he blinked the tears from his eyes and looked up at me blankly. Finally, I asked him what seemed like the obvious question to ask an educated professional living in Gulu in 1997. "Have you ever thought of leaving?" He looked startled. "Leave? Where would I go?" The Lord's Resistance Army made life so miserable in Gulu that when Ebola broke out there a few years after my first visit, many locals counted it as a lucky break. True, Ebola took the lives of 36 people, but the Ebola outbreak also brought the outside world to Gulu in the form of an influx of unusually well-behaved Ugandan government troops, generous international aid organizations, journalists, and cable news crews. The foreigners handed out food and medicine and spent money like water. They paid for local translators, drivers, expediters, and aides. For a few weeks in the fall of 2000, Gulu made CNN nearly every day. During those same few weeks, there were no LRA attacks on Gulu. For a short time, until the mobile medical units were packed up, the cable TV crews went home and the rebels returned, farmers could harvest crops, people could walk around at night, and children could sleep in their homes rather than in schools and hospital compounds. Death by hemorrhagic fever was a risk, to be sure, but it was hardly worse than the risk of being hacked to pieces by machetes or clubbed to death with heavy sticks. When Ebola came to Gulu in 2000, it was Matthew Lukwena who first identified the disease and reported it to national and then international authorities. 12 of his nurses died helping Ebola patients, and others quit for fear of contracting the disease. But Matthew Lukwena stayed and continued to tend his patients. The outbreak was slowly brought under control, thanks in large part to his efforts. In late November, he fell ill himself. On December 5th, he died, the Gulu Ebola outbreak's last victim. Inconsolable sorrow. Everywhere I traveled, I met people like Matthew, Ben, and Sister Rakeli. In Kosovo, I met a woman judge whose husband and sons had been gunned down in the street in front of her. In Indonesia, I met a man who had been tortured almost to death by an army unit notorious for such behavior. In Gaza, I met families whose homes had been mortared by Israeli forces, sometimes with their children still inside. In Sierra Leone, I met dead-eyed children whose arms had been hacked off by Fode Sanko's Revolutionary United Front. It was the same all over, in so many places, and everywhere I felt the same emotions. Fear and shame. Fear because wars and repression are terrifying things. You couldn't spend long hours each day listening to tales of grief, pain, and brutality and not find yourself lying awake in the night, wondering if that was gunfire you were hearing in the distance and if it was getting closer or if the creaking floorboards outside heralded the approach of something terrible. No, nothing very dramatic ever happened to me. Getting held up by armed bandits in Fallujah was as bad as it got. In the occasional moments of true danger, I found myself much calmer than in moments of quiet safety. When I was invited by a drunken and menacing group of Ugandan soldiers to ride with them to their barracks in their truck and interview some just-captured LRA child soldiers, I was so distracted by my inability to find a working pen that I temporarily forgot that no one on Earth knew where I was or where I was going. Reunited later that night with my more experienced Human Rights Watch colleague, I got a thorough scolding. Did I have any idea how stupid and irresponsible it was to go off like that without even letting anyone know I was going? No? Well, never, ever do something so juvenile and stupid again. Similarly, when Israeli soldiers started firing into a crowd of civilians as I waited at a Ramallah border crossing, I found myself full of foolhardy, righteous American outrage. They're shooting. There are children here. They can't do that. That my Palestinian escort had to grab my arm to keep me from racing toward the young soldiers and giving them a piece of my mind. And in Sierra Leone, flying in a rattling old Russian-made helicopter leased by the U.S. Embassy with a notorious war criminal panting sweatily on my right, Sam Mosquito Bakari, an open door on my left, and treetops rushing by just a few feet beneath us, I somehow managed to fall asleep. It was only at night, tucked comfortably into bed, that I felt my heart gallop with adrenaline-fueled panic. The other recurring emotion was shame. Shame at my privileged life. Shame at my inability to cure sick babies, rescue terrified prisoners, or end brutal conflicts. Shame at feeling, even when things got scary, the anticipatory pleasure of getting back home and telling friends and family about my adventures. Most of all, I felt shame at the knowledge that I would go home to safety, and virtually no one back in the prosperous, rich United States would likely lose a single moment of sleep wondering if we should do something to help those countless suffering people so many worlds away. A few years after returning from my first trip to Uganda, I was speaking on the phone with Angelina Atiam, the mother of one of the abducted Aboke schoolgirls. She had happy news. Her own teen daughter had escaped from the LRA rebels, though she had been raped and given birth to a baby while in captivity. Still, she was alive. The baby was healthy, and she was back with her mother. I digested that, then asked after Ben, the dignified man with the injured arm, who had been so confident that once the world knew of their troubles, help would arrive. Had his daughter escaped or been rescued? Ah, no, said Angelina. She is still with the rebels, maybe, or maybe she is dead. No one can say. No one knows. And Ben himself, I asked. How was Ben? Ah, said Angelina. Ben. He is dead. I wasn't sure I wanted to hear the answer, but I asked anyway. What did he die of? Through the crackling telephone line, Angelina's husky, lilting Ugandan voice made each syllable separate and distinct. Inconsolable sorrow. Responsibility to protect. I was far from the only one mired in shame. By the late 1990s, the massacres in Rwanda and the Balkans had left the international community in full self-flagellation mode, pledging, again, that never again would atrocities be permitted to go on unhindered by international action. Never again would the world stand by and do nothing in the face of genocide, ethnic cleansing, or other mass atrocities. Never mind principles of sovereignty. If necessary, the instruments of war would be used to restore peace. Just wars would save the unjustly threatened, and international courts, such as the criminal tribunals for Yugoslavia and Rwanda and the International Criminal Court, would prosecute the military and political leaders responsible for genocide. But even in the post-Cold War world, and even when faced with the most egregious of circumstances, the Security Council could not necessarily be relied upon to authorize military interventions for humanitarian purposes. The looming threat of vetoes had helped preclude meaningful Security Council action on Rwanda, and the same was true during the Kosovo crisis of 1998 to 1999. In Kosovo, though, when ethnic cleansing of Kosovar Albanians by the Serbian government seemed imminent, NATO states, led by the United States, decided not to wait for Security Council authorization. They went ahead and started bombing Serbian targets. Interestingly, neither NATO nor the United States attempted to put forward a formal legal justification for the military intervention in Kosovo. They offered policy and humanitarian justifications for the use of force, but in the United States, the State Department Legal Advisor's Office made a deliberate decision to refrain from proffering a legal justification. In part, U.S. and NATO lawyers feared that other states would not accept any legal justification they might put forward for a military intervention launched without Security Council approval. And in part, they were afraid that other states would accept their logic. That is, they didn't want to put forward a legal theory that would be roundly repudiated by numerous other states. That would be embarrassing and would retard the development of any new norm permitting humanitarian intervention. But they were equally uneasy about the longer-term implications of creating a new norm permitting humanitarian interventions.